Welcome to Inside Politics. I'm Dana Bash. We start at the Supreme Court, where the justices appear deeply divided over one of the biggest abortion cases since Roe versus Wade was overturned. The issue is whether an Idaho abortion ban prevents doctors from performing abortions for women who are having a medical emergency that may not be life-threatening, but is a threat to her health. CNN's Paula Reed and Meg Terrell are here to break it down. Paula, I'm going to start with you. Give us sort of a synopsis of what we have heard. Obviously, not just the arguments, but maybe more importantly, the kinds of questions the justices are asking.
Yeah, so this case specifically focused on the state of Idaho. There's an abortion ban there. But when it comes to emergency medical treatment for pregnant women, there is an exception. Abortions can be performed if a woman's life is at risk. The Biden administration sued the state of Idaho, saying, wait a second, it shouldn't get that far. If you need to perform this procedure to stabilize someone, that should be sufficient under federal law, which is how we found ourselves today at the Supreme Court. And from what we heard, I think the most interesting takeaway is that the votes of Chief Justice John Roberts and Amy Coney Barrett seem to be up for grabs. And that's a little bit of a surprise, because I think a lot of folks might think, well, of course they're going to side with Idaho. But in fact, based on the questioning that we heard today, both of them seemed open. And that's critical, because they would, of course, be key swing votes here.
Right. And this, the key here is, as I mentioned at the open, this is the most significant case that is dealing with the ramifications of what this very court did a few years ago, which is the Dobbs decision overturning Roe versus Wade, and the very real issue that many medical providers are having in a lot of these red states where there are very strict abortion bans on where they believe the law is and what they can do and, frankly, not get sued.
Yeah, or lose their medical license, or in Idaho, face 2 to 5 years in prison if they violate the state ban. And so what we're hearing is that this has a couple different effects. One, doctors tell us and patients tell us, we've been to Idaho to talk to folks there about this, they tell us they're afraid to be pregnant in the state of Idaho, because if you have a situation like this where you have to wait until you're at death's door, oftentimes that means that doctors will be afraid to provide that treatment. And what we hear is that now they're counseling patients that they need insurance to be flown out of state to be able to get that kind of care, rather than the doctors putting themselves at risk by providing it within that state. And we actually heard some numbers about this. They are small numbers, but they show that there's been an increase as a result of this Entala situation. Last year, the largest hospital system in Idaho said that they had to transfer one patient out of state because of this kind of situation. This year, in just the first few months of the year, since this Entala ban essentially was lifted and the full ban went into effect in Idaho, there's been 6 patients transferred out of state. They say if you annualize that, that's 20 patients. It's a rare situation that this happens, obviously, from these numbers, but it obviously affects people.
And Paula, you made the point about Amy Coney Barrett and the Chief Justice John Roberts asking a lot of questions that make it clear that they are open to siding perhaps with the liberals on the bench. Just zeroing in on Amy Coney Barrett, she was asking, what happens if a doctor, quote, reached the conclusion in good faith that an abortion was medically necessary, but prosecutors disagreed? Would they be prosecuted under the Idaho law? Asking questions like that, which, sort of goes to the very heart of why this is such an issue, obviously, first and foremost, policy-wise, but also politically across the country, because these are questions being asked in courts of law, in legislatures, that have to do mostly with how a doctor and a patient view, in this case, a very dire situation that doesn't necessarily just mean, will I save the life of a mother, but will I save the mother's ability to have children again if she wants to.
Yeah, exactly. And that specific hypothetical was brought up by another justice. And you really hit on one of the key exchanges here about the fact that Idaho is suggesting that really a doctor's judgment may be subject to the judgment of a prosecutor. That's what Amy Coney Barrett was getting at there. And so often we listen to Supreme Court arguments and we think about everything, along this liberal conservative framework, but here it was actually the ladies of the court, all the women, the 3 liberal justices joined by Amy Coney Barrett, who dominated the first half and really grilled the lawyer who was representing Idaho, Josh Turner. This was his first argument before the Supreme Court. And at times, it did show. He got some pretty tough questions, some hypotheticals, questions like that. But it does appear that it's possible the government might prevail here. And we know that whatever is decided here could not only have implications for women who need this service, but also potentially for the election.
That is so interesting, that point you made about all of the women asking specific questions. I mean, whether or not they're conservatives or liberals, talk about representation mattering. Thanks so much for that explanation to both of you. Right now at the Supreme Court, there are really big protests happening as all of this is playing out. CNN's Gabe Cohen is there in the thick of it. Gabe, what's going on?
We will not stop. We will not be done.
Well, Sedana, you can see behind me a speaker talking to this a crowd of demonstrators for abortion rights.
And
this has been a large crowd over the past couple hours that they've been listening to some of these speakers. And we've seen some tense moments because on the other side of those barricades is an anti-abortion group of activists who are protesting. As you probably can't really tell, there's really no crowd outside there. It's only a handful of people. But we just a few minutes ago listened to a group of anti-abortion activists who were really trolling the speakers here. They were yelling back and forth. There was a lot of clashing. We've seen a couple incidents of that over the past couple hours here. But Dana, a lot of emotions as we're hearing from people. I spoke with a doctor from Idaho who talked about, she says she used to provide abortion care, but over the past couple of years with this restrictive law, it's really not possible. And she's concerned with the number of patients who are fleeing the state of Idaho to get care, as well as other states with these restrictive laws, and concerns about those patients who have these medical emergencies and are struggling to get the abortion care they need.
To say we will not stop.
Gabe, thank you so much for that reporting.
And I just want you to stay with me. I wanted to be in your bones.
If you can still hear me, thank you so much. Appreciate it. I want to come back into the studio and bring in my great political panel, CNN's MJ Lee, CNN's David Chalian, and Nia Malika Henderson of CNN and Bloomberg. Wow, there's a lot going on this morning. And I just want to start where we began the program, which is obviously the abortion issue, what is happening at the court. And David Chalian, talk about how you see that playing. I'm not asking you for a crystal ball because that doesn't exist, but the here and the now, how that plays into the existing strategy inside the Biden campaign on this issue.
Just look at the campaign schedule this week alone in the last 2 days from the vice president and the president. Vice President Harris was in Battleground, Wisconsin, talking about abortion rights on Monday. President Biden was in Florida trying to see if he can make it a battleground by talking about abortion rights down there in Tampa yesterday. And the entire strategy here is this is from the Democratic side is this is an issue they have watched over the last 2 years work to their political benefit. Mm-hmm. In special elections that have happened in very red states like Kansas or in battleground states or congressional districts, time and again, when this issue is on the ballot, It draws support to a coalition of abortion rights supporters that the Biden team believes they can put to their effort of success, their hope for success this fall. I would just say, obviously, voters this fall are going to have a whole constellation of issues that they're going to vote on. This is not going to be the only issue. But the Biden team sees this as a critical component to putting their coalition together.
And MJ, let's listen to a little bit of President Biden on this issue on the trail.
Millions of women who are enduring unbearable pain and cruelty because of Donald Trump. Sadly, it's pain and cruelty that millions of women in Florida now face. It's not inevitable. We can stop it. When you vote, we can stop it.
If you didn't hear that, Florida, that's what he was talking about, because that's where he was yesterday, which was certainly not on the Biden campaign's plan before Florida, at least not in an earnest way, before Florida implemented or is set to implement a very restrictive 6-week abortion ban.
Yeah, and you know, it's key, I think, that he is using language like cruelty, like pain. You know, we've seen the Biden campaign, the White House too, really trying to use sort of these anecdotes and stories from women, their families in a whole number of different states who have had problems getting access to the health care that they need. And one step further than that is to say, you know, here are the stories, here are the ways in which families are being affected. And by the way, this is all because of Donald Trump's first presidency. And what's more, this is more of what we will see if Donald Trump gets a second term, if Republicans have any say in any of these matters. Mm-hmm. And I think they're betting on the fact that enough people will sort of understand when they hear these stories, when they see these kinds of pictures, that that is not sort of the America that they want for themselves, for their families, their friends. That is sort of the political calculation that they're making.
Let's look at the national landscape, Nia, about what abortion looks like in a lot of these states, including and especially just on the raw politics of this, expected swing states or battleground states. Completely banned with very limited exceptions. You see all of these states. Arizona is really the key one here, which we've talked a lot about in recent weeks. Mm-hmm. And then the 6-week to 12-week bans, Florida, Georgia, those are two critical battleground states. And then if you look ahead to North Carolina as well. And so, you know, let's be real here. The president of the United States is kind of limited in what he can do on putting Roe back in place without Congress and everything else. But what the Biden campaign and Democrats can do is rally enthusiasm, particularly in the states that matter the most. And on that note, you, of course, have ballot proposals in a lot of these states. Arizona, Arkansas, Colorado, Florida, Maryland, and it goes on and on. The key ones from a presidential perspective are Arizona, Florida, Nevada.
Yeah. Listen, Bloomberg's got a poll out today of swing states, and it shows that for half of the voters in these states, abortion is a very, very important issue to their vote. In Arizona, you look at independent voters, according to our poll, they trust Biden on these issues by 12 points over Trump, and suburban women trust Biden over Trump by 25 points. So that is the sort of constellation of voters that they are looking at energizing. As you said, there's obviously going to be a ballot initiative on the ballot there that Democrats are pushing. Republicans are meeting, I think, today to figure out what kind of ballot initiative they can put on the roster in November as well.
We're going to talk later in the show about the raw anti-Semitism that is not just popping up, but exploding on some campuses. But right here, I want to talk about the raw politics of what continues to concern the Biden campaign, which is maybe another star in that constellation that you talked about of issues that both campaigns are dealing with, and in this case, the Biden campaign. And that is how the war in the Middle East, particularly Israel prosecuting its retaliation in Gaza, is affecting voters in the Biden coalition. Just look at the Harvard IOP youth survey that was came out last month. The economy obviously is number one, immigration and so on and so forth. Interestingly, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is only 2%. What does that tell you, David?
Well, the Biden team was very pleased to see that that was not ranking as high as perhaps news coverage would suggest.
And I should say, forgive me, but I should also add that approval of the way Biden is handling the Israel-Hamas war among young people is only 18%.
Yes, and I was just about to say, so in salience as an important issue among these voters in this poll, you see it's low down there. But we are seeing his numbers actually getting worse on this issue. I mean, this is now starting to be an immigration territory for him as an issue. It's one of his worst performing issues, his handling of the Israel-Hamas war, and especially within his own coalition. So again, when you're dealing with such a close presidential race, as this one is supposed to be, every piece of that coalition is as important as the other. And so as an animating issue for some voters inside that Democratic coalition, young voters, what have you, this is really important, and Biden's not performing well with it for those voters.
And MJ, you have some brand new reporting on what the Biden campaign is and is not doing with regard to these protests.
Yeah, you know, for starters, the president is going to be in New York City at the end of the week, but he is not going to be making a visit to Colombia, for example, to see for himself and hear for himself some of these impassioned voices, see the protesters.
Why is that?
I don't I don't think that the campaign right now sees an upside. I mean, first of all, the logistics of having the president go into such a messy situation, I think from a security standpoint, not to mention the political standpoint, it would just be very, very challenging. And on the whole, when I've spoken to White House officials and campaign officials about this very issue in recent weeks, they have been incredibly consistent in saying we plan on staying the course. There are not some big political meetings that are happening inside the White House or in Wilmington HQ where advisors are trying to come up with some brand new, different strategy to deal with the Gaza issue. They're sensitive to it. They know that it is a challenge, but they don't believe that this is something where they need to have a different tack to deal with it. They don't see this as a politically sort of existential problem right now.
And we don't know where it's going to be
come
the fall on the ground, and that will dictate a lot.
And I mean, you have seen the president move on this, right? Mm-hmm. He's been much more vocal in terms of his criticism of Netanyahu, for instance. We'll see how this plays out. He's going to Morehouse to give a commencement address next month. That coalition of voters important to a state like Georgia, it's sort of, you know, upper educated black voters who could be critical in a state like Georgia. I'm certain that they're going to be protests there. Mm-hmm. There's already a protest even before he gets there with people wanting them to rescind the invitation. Morehouse has said they don't plan to do that, but I'm sure it will be a scene.
And he's trying to sort of walk that line. He put out a strong statement over the weekend about anti-Semitism that is growing, and then the next day put out a statement supporting the idea of pro-Palestinian protests. And, you know, that's a line that is not going to please pretty much anybody, which is very, very difficult to do. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. I should also add that the House Speaker is going to go to Columbia today, which is going to open up another point of political attack. Coming up next, he just can't help himself. Did Donald Trump violate his gag order at the same time a judge is considering whether to punish him for it? We'll talk about that next.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. Celebrities of all kinds are speaking publicly about their therapeutic trips, so to speak. It turns out there is a burgeoning industry ready to serve the new influx of people who find themselves turning away from traditional mental health therapy. The gap between what we know and what we don't about psychedelic therapy. Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Moments ago at the White House, President Biden signed a long-awaited aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan into law. Two-thirds of the $95 billion package is for Ukraine, and it comes at a pivotal moment in that country's fight for its survival. CNN's Kayla Tausche joins me live now from the White House. Kayla.
Well, Dana, this was a moment literally months in the making. President Biden saying this morning from the White House that the first tranche of that aid to Ukraine would be available or would be sent from the U.S. within hours. And the Pentagon then detailing exactly what is in that initial tranche that the U.S. is going to be sending. It will include munitions of varying sizes, various rounds of artillery, high-mobility artillery rocket systems, commonly known as HIMARS, as well as tactical vehicles and other anti-armor systems. But in those remarks, Biden was chiding Congress for how long it took to get this package passed. The administration first notified Congress of its request for more funding for conflicts all across hotspots around the world, in late October, so it took more than 6 months to get it across the finish line. But Biden did praise some Republican leaders by name, namely House Speaker Mike Johnson, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, and said that bipartisan cooperation is sending a strong message to both America's allies around the world and its adversaries. Here's President Biden.
All standing together against this brutal dictator. Putin attacks a NATO ally like he's attacking Ukraine today. We'd have no choice but to come to their aid. America stands with our friends. We stand up against dictators. We bow to no one, certainly not Vladimir Putin.
So that is President Biden issuing essentially a missive from the whole of NATO, saying that they will not bow down to Vladimir Putin. But Dana, what's interesting is that the administration publicly had said that Ukraine would be running out of weaponry and equipment by the end of December, and it still took nearly 5 months to get this package passed. And so there are active questions about when, not if, but when Ukraine needs more, how long it will take then. Dana.
Thank you so much, Kayla, for that reporting. And now he simply cannot stop, or maybe it's just a strategy. Donald Trump will not relent in how he breaks a gag order imposed on him by the judge overseeing his Manhattan hush money trial. Just last night, as the judge weighs whether or how to punish the former president for 10 instances the prosecution claims he flaunted restrictions on what he can say, Trump seems to have just ignored the rules again. Here's what he said about a witness, Michael Cohen, in an interview with CNN affiliate WPVI.
Michael Cohen is a convicted liar, and he's got no credibility whatsoever. He was a lawyer, and you rely on your lawyers.
Joining me now, CNN legal analyst Carrie Cardero and CNN correspondent Kara Scannell, who has been CNN's eyes and ears and then some inside the courtroom covering this trial. Kara, I do want to start with you on this gag order. What is the expectation? What are you hearing from your sources in the court? Any sense of, I mean, we don't know how it's going to come down, but even the when.
Well, we're waiting for the judge to issue this decision. Yesterday, after the hearing, he said he would reserve decision on this. But it came after what was a, at times, contentious hearing, with the judge becoming frustrated with Donald Trump's legal team trying to not responding to his questions, as he put it, because prosecutors have said that Trump has violated this gag order at least 10 times. They have the interview that you just played a clip of. Trump actually gave yesterday morning on his way to court before this hearing took place, but it echoes some of the other statements that prosecutors have said are problematic. So the judge was pressing Trump's attorneys in court about, you know, what was he responding to? Because their argument has been that Trump is a candidate. He should be able to respond to political attacks. They were saying statements from Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels were political. And the judge just kept pressing, saying, what was political about this? What is he responding to here? Mm-hmm. And at one point, one of the other arguments that they made is that Trump's lawyers said that he was just reposting what other people were posting. But the judge was challenging that, too. And at one point, he grew frustrated saying, you know, Trump's lawyers saying, trying to argue again, you know, but Your Honor. And then the judge saying, I was not done. You were not giving me anything to hang my hat on to say, yeah, you're right, the repost, that was ambiguous. So judge just becoming frustrated and saying that Trump's attorney was losing credibility because he was not able to answer the judge's questions.
And Carrie, the court is not in session today on this particular case, but we are now in the middle of the David Pecker testimony. We heard it most of the day, not all day yesterday. We expect it to resume tomorrow. The court is releasing the actual transcripts. And part of what I want to read from the testimony that they released last night is David Pecker talking about Trump's involvement specifically. And he said, I would describe Mr. Trump as very knowledgeable. I would describe him as very detail oriented. I would describe him as almost as a micromanager from what I saw, that he looked at all aspects of whatever the issue was. From a lawyer's perspective, why is that such important testimony?
Well, it's important because one of the main things that the prosecutors have to prove in this case is that the former president was knowledgeable about the fraud that is alleged to have taken place. And so this general characterization of the former president as being a micromanager, being involved in the details of things, sort of goes along that path of him having knowledge of the fraud that the prosecutors say takes place. But
you know, the other aspect of Mr. Packer's testimony is that it is not generally, it is not illegal to do sleazy things to influence an election in the way of trying to win it. And I think the big challenge for the prosecutors in this case is distinguishing between the fraud and the actual way to affect the election in an illegal way that is different than just sort of unsavory conduct.
Yeah, they're clearly, the prosecution is clearly with Pecker trying to lay the groundwork of Donald Trump being somebody who would never allow for alleged fraudulent documents to be, you know, to go forward without him knowing about it. And
right.
So that's clearly part of this.
Right.
Thank you. Sorry it's short. We're going to have a lot more to talk about
on
this
today.
In the next few weeks. Thank you so much, Kara, as well. Up next, the Biden White House is staying far away from Trump's legal problems. But what about the Biden reelection campaign? Stay tuned. Welcome back. While Donald Trump is stuck in court, President Biden is keeping a very robust schedule of campaign events. Since the Trump trial began last week, he has been to Pennsylvania, Joe Biden has, to talk about the economy, Virginia to talk about clean energy, and Florida to talk about abortion. Here to talk with me about all of that and much more, the man who masterminded Barack Obama's election and reelection, CNN senior political commentator David Axelrod. Does mastermind, I hope that is a positive connotation.
Yeah, I know it sounds kind of Batman-ish.
It does. I don't know. I feel like I would own that if I were you.
Yeah, okay.
Let's talk about the Trump trial and the other side of the ledger, so to speak. Mm-hmm. How do you think that the Biden campaign is playing this?
I think well, actually, because I don't think he should be involving himself in the details of that. But it is an opportunity for him to go out and talk about the future and talk about the contrast on substantive issues. And I think ultimately a message that works for him is, I'm focused on your future, he's focused on his past. Mm. And this is very much being reflected in what's going on right now.
I mean, do you think any of the sort of witch hunt, all of the things that Donald Trump is saying, most of which is totally not based in evidence or truth, has any legs?
Listen, I think what he's doing now, and you know, this judge is, good luck to the judge trying to contain Trump. He's not going to put him in jail, and $1,000 fine is not going to stop him from talking, or I think any amount. He is pre-spinning the result of this out of fear that it could be a conviction. It may not be. And this is what he did, as you know, before the election.
Yep.
So this is what he does. And there may be, particularly if there's a hung jury, there may be some sympathy for him. But I think primarily among his own supporters.
Let's talk about some of the elections that are still going on, the primary elections, and what that might tell us about November.
Yeah.
Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, those famous collar counties around the suburbs,
yeah,
around Philadelphia. I want you to look at some of the results. This is on the Republican side. Delaware County, Donald Trump got 76%, Nikki Haley, 24%.
Yeah.
Bucks County, Trump 81, Nikki Haley 19. Montgomery County, Trump 75, Nikki Haley 25. I just want to remind our viewers, Nikki Haley is not
yes,
running for president.
And hasn't been for quite a while.
Exactly. So what does that tell you?
Well, there's obviously resistance to Trump. And this was a closed primary, so these were Republicans voting. There is a contingent of Republican voters who are reluctant about Trump. I'm sure this trial isn't helping their feelings about that. And this was a way to express that. The question is, does that translate into a vote for Biden?
And what's your feeling on that?
You know, I think some portion of them will. But we are a very tribal society right now politically, and when people see the D and the R, a bunch of that is going to melt away. But in a marginal race, it could be a difference.
You're inside the Biden campaign right now. How do you reach those voters?
Listen, I think that the voters who are not engaged right now are very much about economics. Mm. This is why the objective fact is the U.S. is doing very, very well compared to other countries, but insisting on that and getting credit for it was not a winning strategy. talking about how you're fighting to bring down costs, talking about how you're going after predatory interests who are gouging consumers, mm-hmm. Those are winners. And putting Trump on the other side of issues like the tax cut, the 2017 tax cut that favored the wealthy, that will come up for renewal. Those are winners for Biden. And I think, you know, pitching himself as Joe from Scranton fighting for the working person is a better pitch than President Biden telling you what a great job he's done on the economy.
Really interesting. David, always good to see you.
Always good
especially
to see you.
Especially in person.
Yeah.
Thank you. Up next, protests swallow college campuses and show the difficulties of disentangling legitimate grievances from the ugliest anti-Semitism.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
From New York to California, you've likely seen images like this of students protesting Israel's handling of its retaliation against Hamas terrorists, the war that's happening in Gaza. Students at Columbia and at least 11 other universities staged Gaza solidarity camps. If that's all we were talking about, pro-Palestinian protests, well, protests on campuses are nothing new. But there's a critically important line between free speech and hate. Hate that is making Jewish students at these schools feel scared and unsafe, and in some cases, not because of differences over the war, but because they are Jews. And since the brutal October 7th massacre by Hamas inside Israel, we've seen that line crossed over and over again. This is what Jewish students are hearing on and around college campuses.
You'll see that. Yeah. Go back to Poland. Who says that?
Go back to Poland.
You guys are right.
Get the hell
out of here. Hamas, we love you. Hamas, a terrorist organization. And it's not just dangerous words. Jewish students say they are being assaulted on campus.
My friend on Saturday night was full-blown assaulted. He had, you know, he was shoved around. He had his flag stolen and they tried to burn it.
I will not walk on that campus with my kippah on. I was personally assaulted. My friend was personally assaulted.
I've been physically intimidated and harassed.
No student should ever fear displaying their faith at a school, a place that is supposed to be fertile ground for freedom of expression, whether it is a Christian student or a Muslim student or a Jewish student. Joining me from Providence, Rhode Island is Jillian Letterman. She is the president of Brown University Students for Israel and chair of Hillel's Israel Leadership Network. And here in Washington, Adam Lehman, CEO of Hillel, the largest Jewish campus organization in the world. Jillian, I'm going to start with you up in Providence this morning. Dozens of Brown students formed a Gaza solidarity camp on your campus. You gave us a video that we are going to show. What was it like walking by that?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on. The protest formed early this morning. About 80 students decided to follow suit from students at Columbia and at Yale and at other schools by setting up camps, by setting up tents on main campus space, dozens of tents set up, forming a Gaza solidarity encampment. There are multiple students who are now joining the protest who are pledging to stay there indefinitely until Brown University divests from what they say are weapons manufacturers funding a genocide in Israel. Walking through the protest felt very much like walking through many of the other protests that have occurred on campus throughout the past 6 months. But what I will say is that it is uniquely framed in light of what's been happening at other campuses over the past couple of days. When you see the violence happening at Columbia, the violence happening at Yale, Thankfully, that has not happened at Brown. It has remained peaceful. I'm hopeful that it will remain peaceful, but the context of other campuses has made this protest incredibly unique.
Yeah, well, let's hope that, especially given the fact that the ADL just recently did a survey on college campuses around the country, and Brown got a D when it comes to anti-Semitism. This is before everything that we're seeing now. Adam, here in Washington, I want to read you, speaking of the ADL, something that Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the ADL, wrote in an op-ed on CNN.com. He went to Columbia's Hillel, met with about 80 Jewish students. He said, one depicted the assault of a Jewish classmate, an Israeli flag ripped from his hand. Another showed a Jewish student being screamed at by a fully masked individual who came right up to his face, his voice shaking with fury. He went on to say, demonstrators calling openly for Hamas to burn Tel Aviv. We heard that ourselves. Others yelling that October 7th is about to be every day. What I want to know from you is if you have any sense from the Jewish students you talk to all over the country, all over the world, but specifically, let's start here in the U.S., why is this happening? Why is it going from basic protest, free speech, to intimidation and sometimes some scary violence?
Yeah, thank you for having us on this conversation, Dana. It's really quite simple. There are organizations like National Students for Justice in Palestine that are not interested in dialogue and debate. They're not interested in even necessarily simply supporting Palestinians. They are interested in advancing a political worldview in the end that reflects the goals of Hamas, of Hezbollah, of Iran, and they are using campuses as an instrument to try to effectuate that change. And unfortunately, a lot of students who understandably want to think about and express compassion towards Palestinians, hopefully they think the same towards Israelis, you know, the victims of 10/7 and others who've been so adversely impacted. But even with all of that, they are getting, in my view, co-opted into a political movement that, as we have seen, has been marked by hateful, discriminatory, and violent speech and actual harassment and violence spawning from those protests.
What are you encouraging university presidents to do to try to separate the genuine freedom of speech protest from what you are describing as much more insidious and maybe even in some cases completely separate from what the students are experiencing on campus?
Yeah, first of all, I think we have to call this free speech argument for what it is, which is a red herring. Mm-hmm. The campuses involved in this story and really the hundreds of other campuses where we've seen protests have provided ample time, place, and space for protest, however passionate or aggressive students want to be in those spaces. Students are running, and non-students coming in to take advantage, running roughshod over those parameters. So administrators need to just continue to do what they can achieve in reasserting control over the campus.
How should they do that? Do they need better help from law enforcement?
They absolutely need help from law enforcement. We appreciate that the president has spoken out in ways that recognize the anti-Semitism and completely unacceptable conditions, but we need law enforcement coordination at a federal and local level. And frankly, there are a lot of universities that have done better, and they've done better by getting ahead of these problems. It took months for administrators at Columbia and many of their impacted schools to take action. It concerns me a lot as we look toward graduations.
And Jillian, on that note, we only have a short time left. Do you feel that, I mean, let's just, you are at Brown. You said that things are a little bit more sedate there, but do you feel that at Brown they're getting out ahead of what could happen just with the encampment starting to come up today?
I think they are. I think it's a testament to the administration. They sent out a message yesterday saying that the encampments did violate the university's code of conduct, that if they escalate, action will be taken. There are university officials out staged at the encampment, taking down students' IDs, ensuring that things do not get out of hand. Mm-hmm. And so I hugely credit my administration for responding in that way, and I think that other universities should follow suit.
Okay. Thank you so much, Jillian Letterman and Adam Lehman of Hillel. Appreciate both of you and your time this morning. We'll be right back.
You ready?
Last hour, a promise of a court fight from TikTok's CEO, just minutes after President Biden signed a bill into law that could change the way Americans use the notoriously popular and controversial app. Until that happens, because the president signed that into law, the clock is ticking for TikTok's Chinese-owned parent to sell the app. Here's the only catch. They only have 9 months to do it. Beijing has said it strongly opposes a forced sale of TikTok and won't approve the sale of its algorithm, citing national security grounds. That leaves few options to secure the future of TikTok in the U.S., its biggest market with 170 million users. Thank you so much for joining a very busy Inside Politics today. CNN News Central starts after the break.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, host of the Chasing Life podcast. In honor of our 10th season, we want to hear from you. Leave us a message at 470-396-0832. And tell us how you chase life. It could be used on an upcoming episode.